Welcome to the good, the bad, and the ugly of self-storage, your go-to podcast for mastering the self-storage industry. Join host Michael Cunningham and his son Dylan Cunningham as they share insider knowledge, firsthand experiences, and practical advice. Each episode, they dive into real stories from lucrative deals and strategic renovations to the challenges and pitfalls that await. Whether you're a seasoned operator or new to the industry, learn how to succeed, avoid common traps, and seize great opportunities. Tune in to hear their journey, lessons learned, and secrets to making your storage facility a success. Unlock the potential of self-storage with us.
Welcome back, everybody, to the good, the bad, and the ugly of self-storage. I'm Dylan Cunningham, and again, joining me is my dad, Mike Cunningham. Today's episode is going to be about the entitlement and permitting process, kind of navigating the maze before you start building. If you're thinking about building a self-storage facility, this episode is crucial. We're diving into the entitlement and permitting process, what it is, why it's important, and how to navigate it without losing your mind or your investment.
Yeah, Dylan, so when we started looking at the land for the current facility we're developing, did you have any idea how much went into just getting permission to build?
Not a clue. I mean, I thought you just buy the land, submit some plans, and start building. But after seeing the hoops we had to jump through, I realized it's way more complicated than that. So with that being said, let's start with entitlements. When we say entitlements, we're talking about the approvals and rights you need from the city or county before you can develop your property, right?
Correct. And so when you think about with us, what was the first thing we did when we were evaluating our current project?
We checked the zoning. You know, we had to make sure the land was actually zoned for self-storage.
Exactly. You know, people think that's too simplistic, that there's more to it. But the reality is the most important thing that you can do initially is just make sure the property's zoned for self-storage.
Got it. I know there's some other key things you need to check before you even think about buying the land. So I want you to elaborate on each one of those things. So let's start with zoning.
Okay. So just like I said, you want to make sure that it's zoned for self-storage. Now, there are options to get a conditional use permit or change the zoning, and it seems like a difficult road to go down. So I would probably avoid those options. So initially, if you're just getting started trying to build your first facility, try to find something that is actually zoned for self-storage.
Gotcha. And what about the consistency of the general plan?
Yeah, so what this means is, you know, the cities have a general plan and they're, you know, forecasting the development in their city. And if self-storage is fitting into, you know, a piece of land that you would like to develop and it's kind of in that scope, you're in a better position. Now, if that's not consistent, they're looking to take that area that you're looking to build in and turn it into biotech or something, or that's all going to be residential, you're going to be in an uphill battle. So you want to find out from the beginning, you know, what their general plan is and if, you know, self-storage fits in that plan.
Right. So if the city's long-term plan supports your project, basically.
Correct.
Okay, so how about some of the setbacks and height restrictions, maybe lot coverage?
Right, so a lot of this is pretty consistent throughout California, but the reality is each city might have a different height restriction. They might have a lot restriction in terms of what the coverage is. Most cities now are really engaged in permeable soil and not over coverage. And if you are, that you have to have detention ponds, and we can get into that in a little bit further along on this podcast, but making sure that what you want to build is going to work within that lot that you have. So finding out these initial key factors really will make the difference whether or not you can move on, look at another piece of land, or if this is something you want to pursue further.
Awesome. And then the last section I kind of wanted you to touch on would be your budget.
Yeah, so, you know, we could probably link something in the notes here in terms of an Excel spreadsheet that we have that we use. But you want to obviously have your acquisition cost in there, all your hard construction costs, professional fees, city and county fees, and financing, and see if the deal's going to pencil out based on that. So, you know, there's kind of a sweet spot in terms of land size in different regions where you're developing, whether it's, you know, super rural or semi-urban or, you know, in a major metro. You really want to know what that sweet spot is, and then you could start to kind of work from that point and, you know, see if the numbers are going to work. As you get, you know, closer to a major metro, where we grew up in the San Francisco Peninsula, now we're starting to see like 2 and 3 story self-storage facilities starting to emerge. And, you know, 20 years ago, everything was all single story. So as the density starts to increase, you start to see that it doesn't work with a single story anymore. You start to have to go to 3, 4 stories to make the numbers work.
Right. And that makes sense. I know you touched on this a little bit, but is it worth applying for a conditional use permit or zone change?
Yeah, as I mentioned before, if this is your first development project, I would discourage anyone from that. It's, you know, typically a 6 to 12 month timeline. Go in front of the city council and kind of plead your case. Again, I mean, if it's in a similar zone, let's say it's in industrial, and they're in need of storage, potentially the city will lean in your favor. But if you're trying to change the zoning to something completely different, it's probably going to be an uphill battle and not worth it. In our experience, it's 6 to 12 months to get this to go through, and no guarantee and money up front. And in the meantime, you're trying to tie up the property, or, you know, potentially the seller of this property doesn't want to tie it up that long. So there's a lot of variables there. I would say for your first deal, this is not somewhere you want to venture into. Try to, again, I can't stress enough, stick to self-storage zoning.
Gotcha. So how important was it to talk to the planning department before making an offer on this piece of land?
Yeah, I think that's super crucial to set up an appointment early, you know, instantly. Let's say you tie up the property and instantly set up an appointment with the planning department and ask for all the key agencies to be involved: public works, fire, engineering, and have them. Part of it will be that you'll need to come in with some sort of site plan, a rendering of what you're thinking you want to propose there, and then have everybody look at it and give their honest feedback whether or not they see any items that might create a problem moving forward, and you could try to address them early in the game. If they're not receptive at that point, I would, you know, again, move on. You know, you're in your due diligence phase of purchasing the property, and that's why you're trying to make sure that it's going to work for you early. So once the zoning checks out, the next big hurdle is environmental review. California has some of the toughest regulations in the country, and it's thanks to CEQA. CEQA is the California Environmental Quality Act.
Yeah, and I feel like if you don't check this out before buying your land, you could end up stuck in a long and expensive approval process.
Exactly.
A couple more topics I wanted to touch on. Just some of the major things to investigate, again, before buying the land. And I wanted you to expand a little bit more on these topics as well for our listeners. Let's start with environmental site assessment.
Yeah, so you're going to want to do what is called a phase one environmental study. And what that does, it does a background check on the property to see if there what the previous use of the land was, if it ever was previously used, if there were any hazardous materials found. They do an initial impact. They check the surrounding properties. Potentially, let's say that there was a gas station close by and there was leakage and contaminated this property. And, you know, just because the gas station wasn't on it doesn't necessarily mean that the property couldn't be contaminated from it. And so you want to make sure what happens with this, the phase one, is if there are things that are of concern, that will provoke you to move on to what is called a phase two environmental. And that's where they'll actually do samples of the soil and, you know, testing and really finding out whether or not there is contamination on the property. So early in the game, again, you're going to have to spend a little bit of money up front. You're going to do this typically during your due diligence phase of purchasing the property. You're gonna have a phase one environmental done on the property. And again, these are just things that if you don't do it and you find out that you've got hazardous waste on your property, it's very, very expensive to mitigate this.
Yeah, that's a nightmare. What about the floodplain and wetlands?
So with the floodplain and wetlands, FEMA has maps online, and you can go and check to see if there's any wetlands identified on this land or adjacent, and that could be an issue because sometimes even if it's adjacent, there's going to be some concerns that potentially it was, or there's seasonal wetlands. And so early in the game, these are just really prudent things to do just to make sure that you're not going to have these, you know, hurdles to battle moving forward. You want to make sure that you try to tackle all this prior to even purchasing the land so that you don't get stuck with having to deal with it.
Right. And if wetlands exist, mitigation is required, correct?
Oh, 100%.
How about the biological and wildlife impact? I know you've probably had some encounters with this topic as well.
Yeah, so California, there's a whole list of endangered species. The burling owl is one of them. There's the fairy shrimp, and it kind of just goes on and on. There's from butterflies to, you know, small reptiles, and it's really, really important that if you're feeling like something's not right, you see, you know, burrow holes everywhere. If there's anything on the land that's really indicating that there might be something here, you definitely want to move forward. And again, this would be during the due diligence phase of purchasing the land and, you know, find out. Again, there are some sites that you can go on to that you can check out whether or not there has been any studies in the region, if there's anything going on with adjacent properties. These are just things, again, the more due diligence that you can do right from the beginning to protect yourself, the better off you are.
Awesome. Well, I guess the last thing I would like you to cover would be cultural and tribal resources.
Yeah, so California has AB 52, and they'll bring in tribal members to consult with you on the property if there's potential of any historical artifacts on your property. You know, again, some regions this is definitely more prevalent than others. If there's known areas that were inhabited by indigenous, then you're really going to have to, you know, be cautious whether or not that's something that you need to investigate further or not.
I know you touched on this a little bit, but what happens if a property has wetlands or endangered species on it?
Yeah, so, I mean, the first and easiest thing is avoidance. So if you could, you know, minimize the impact, if the wetlands could stay on the property, if it's a small portion of the property and you can just leave it and preserve it, that would probably be, you know, the easiest. On-site mitigation is part of that, where if they feel that there's more to it and some of it can be restored and you're willing to do that, they like that option. And then the third option is off-site mitigation. There's both wetland and protected habitat banks that you can buy into. Not cheap, ranging from $300,000 to $350,000 to $400,000 per acre, to mitigate wetlands. So if the property's in a wetland, you know, it's probably best to move on. Again, just trying to make things easy for you. Kind of assuming this is someone's first development, you're just trying to avoid these things that will really make things difficult for you.
Yeah, avoid a $400,000 per acre hurdle.
Exactly.
That's for sure.
Exactly.
Did you have any good, bad, or ugly stories or experiences with cultural and tribal impacts?
Absolutely. It wasn't self-storage related, but we were developing a property in Northern California. It was for 12 townhouses, and it was an infill property. Everything around it was developed. It was on a corner, and it was in a pretty good subdivision. I would say there's probably 1,500 homes in it, and this particular lot had not been developed, and it was zoned multi-residential. And so we started going through the process. Over the years, people had cut through the property so they didn't have to walk all the way around it. So there was a path like going right through the center of it. And I remember part of the due diligence with the city was that the area was known for having tribal artifacts in the region. And so part of our due diligence is that we had to hire a local tribes member to come out and take a look at the property. And I remember meeting the tribesmen out there, and got out of the car and instantly walked on the property. And we weren't there for more than 5 minutes, and she bent down and picked up a rock, and it was right on the surface. And again, this property had been, everything had been graded through this property because of the development all around it. And she picked up a rock and she said, "You see this rock?" And I said, "Yeah, it's a rock." And she said, no, this rock was used to grind corn. And I believe that this is a classic midden. And I didn't know what a midden was. And I went home and researched midden. And a midden is basically a campground, a campsite that the Native Americans would use when they were out on a hunting expedition. So they would typically go to the same places over and over. And a midden would be a place where you'd be able to find artifacts that they would have left behind things. And so she believed that this was a classic midden. And so the recommendation was that they would drill holes every 3 feet and obviously sift through the dirt and see if they could find any artifacts. And so that killed the project. It was going to be just too expensive to do all this work. And so that was a learning lesson, our expensive learning lesson on our behalf. And so
the average person doesn't know what a midden is. I mean, to us, it just looks like a normal rock. I mean, how can you fight against that?
You can't. Then that's why we kind of moved on from that project. We never developed it. And interesting.
So moving on, let's say the land checks out and you believe it's feasible to build. Now comes the fun part, getting your building permits. Can you tell the listeners the importance of each of these steps? I wrote some kind of notes for myself that I would like you to expand on and just kind of talk your way through the process. So let's start with a site plan review.
So a site plan review, initially what you're going to want to do, we talked about this, is, have somebody draft up some initial plan that you would like to propose to the city. And ideally, I think this is a really crucial and an important part to make, point to make, is that, and we've done both ways, is hiring an architect that is two things. One, they're familiar with the city or county that you want to build in, and have had projects go through it. They understand the process. I can't stress that's super important. An architect might argue that point, saying that they can navigate through any city, but there are nuances in each city, and also knowing the players within the city does make a difference. Whether or not people want to believe that or not, it definitely makes a difference. And then secondly, hiring an architect that knows self-storage, that specializes would be perfect, but that's not a game changer, but it at least has done storage facilities in the past and understands what the nuances of self-storages are. I think those two points are absolutely crucial. We've hired architects in the past that have not done self-storage, and I think that has been detrimental and costs us a lot of extra money that we probably could have saved by hiring somebody that really understands this asset class.
Right. So it might cost a little more in the beginning, but you believe that it'll save you much, much more money down the line.
Absolutely.
Perfect. How about traffic and access study?
Yeah.
Can you expand on that?
For sure. In this world where a lot of cities are really, if they don't understand self-storage themselves, and that's where it really helps when you have an architect that understands self-storage, because they're going to be able to explain a lot of this to the city if you're in a city or county that doesn't understand self-storage. We had a personal experience where they see all the square footage and they assume that there's going to be a big traffic impact. And a lot of times they'll ask for traffic studies based on that. And the reality is that self-storage, for every 100 units only impacts about 7 cars per 100 units per day, which is, it's very, very low in retrospect.
Very minimal.
And so these are things that unless a city or county knows this, they could ask for expensive traffic impacts, and it's just not necessary.
Right. How about stormwater and drainage compliance?
Yeah, this is a big deal. And I'm assuming this is everywhere in the country, but definitely in California. So every drop of water that hits your land needs to stay on your land. And we do this through stormwater detention and ponds. There are underground detention ponds. There are above ground ponds. And having an architect and engineer in this case that is looking out for your best interest, trying to find the most cost-effective way of doing this is super important as well. So, yeah, starting with the right people from the beginning makes all the difference in the world throughout the entire project. So, yeah, getting the right people, architect, engineer, right from the beginning to help you designing a stormwater detention system that makes the most sense for your property, again, could make the difference of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars.
What do you think about the current situation we got going on with this project that we're working on? I mean, when I first started, it was during the grading process, and yeah, there's 3 massive holes in the property, and
yeah.
I didn't know what they were. And I remember my dad explaining to me that these were ponds, and I mean, it really takes up a lot of space.
Yeah, so depending on the soil that you have on your property, these stormwater detention ponds can need retaining walls, and it's expensive to build these retaining walls all around a huge pond. The rock, the filter fabric, in this case that we're in here, we have to do a tie back into the stormwater system for the county in the event that we're in a 100-year flood and our stormwater detention ponds overflow, they're pumped into the county system. And there's some redundancy there. You have to have it monitored with 2 motors in case one goes bad. So there's a lot of cost that's associated with this. And so, again, designing the right system that, makes the most sense. We've done other projects where we've done underground stormwater detention system, and the benefits there are you still could use the land and build self-storage over the top of it.
Mm-hmm.
Or it could be through the drive aisles at least. And it's an opportunity to, in my opinion, to maximize the land. And the cost is, in my opinion, again, from the experiences we've had, very similar to an open pond that has to have retaining walls. Now, you could be in some really good clay or rocky soil where that's not the case and not necessary. And then, yeah, an above-ground pond's probably going to make more sense. But these are like the options that you really want the engineer to be able to go over these different options, and that they have a great understanding of all the different options, and they're giving you the most cost-effective way of doing it.
Right. How about the fire department permits? Can you touch a little bit about that?
Yeah, so there are, certain rules and regulations that the fire code has. In the current project we're working on, if the buildings are under 6,000 square feet, then you're not required to put sprinklers, You have to do firewalls.
Interesting.
But not sprinklers. And
what's a firewall for listeners that don't?
Firewalls are using gypsum board, sheetrock. And in this case, they're asking for a 2-hour firewall, which is 2 layers of 5/8 sheetrock on the inside and 2 layers of 5/8 sheetrock on the outside. And that creates a 2-hour firewall. But again, as we got further into the project, I'm not quite certain. I still think the sprinklers would have been more expensive, but it's still probably the prudent thing to do. And if there was ever a fire, your property is going to be saved. So I would probably lean towards putting fire sprinklers in. And I'd also probably lean towards it for multiple reasons, because then you're not being limited to the size of the building and you have much more options on your layout. So again, these are just things that, you know, we've dealt with in the past, but I think these are things that really need to be thought about and looked at in both ways, whether or not firewalls make sense or putting sprinklers in.
Gotcha. And how about the final inspections and certificate of occupancy, you know, once everything is built?
You know, each city is a little bit different, and we probably should talk about this a little further into the podcast, but final inspection, you're going to need something called a certificate of occupancy, and basically that's where they go through and they make sure that everything is compliant with that was on the plans, and that's from signage to handicap parking to if you had to have handicap units. In California, we're segregated to putting in a certain percentage of units that are handicap, and in addition to having parking places, the signage, lighting, all of this has to be, you know, all perfect before they're going to give you your letter of occupancy and allow you to start renting these units. So, you know, just really, you know, the punch list at the end, I think, is really the most important thing. And again, we do a lot of this stuff in-house. We're builder owner on these projects, and we have our own crew that we employ. We'll sub out certain things, you know, fire sprinklers would be a perfect example. All of our finish work on our concrete, we'll hire finishers out. Tie-in, if we're going to do any tie-in work into the city with encroachments, we'll typically hire that out. And so the importance of really having a good general contractor that is diligent on going through every detail on the plans and making sure that's been punched prior to the final is very important.
So you mentioned utility tie-ins. Can you expand a little on that?
Yeah, I kind of just touched on that a little bit. Utility tie-ins would be like tying in for sewer, water, or electricity. And all these things are really expensive, and they should really be investigated, you know, prior to purchasing the land. So if there's not water or sewer on the property, where is it? And what's it going to cost to get to it? Is it down the street? Is it across the street? How much is that going to cost to tie into that? And then utilities, is what you're putting in going to exceed the transformer that's, you know, next to your property, or you're going to have to add a transformer? In the past, transformers, we were having a supply chain issue on transformers, and that could tie a project up. One of the projects we were on, it was 8 months to get a transformer. And so,
wow.
These are just things that you if this is your first build, you're not even thinking about these things. And it's just, I'm trying to, you know, touch on some key things where we've had, you know, you talk about the good, bad, and the ugly. These have been some of the bad and the ugly of development. None of, you know, it gets smoother the more you do, of course, but there's always going to be hiccups on each project, no matter, you know, as much as you try.
Well, I think that was a great explanation of kind of the whole permitting process. I'd like to jump into a little bit more specifics on the project that we are currently working on right now. Could you tell the listeners, you know, tell them about what happened on this current project with the fire hydrants? I mean, I know that was a little bit of a headache.
Yeah, so the original engineer on this project drew in, so this particular project is 3.7 acres, and we're building 77,400 square feet of self-storage, and the engineer had drawn in 14 fire hydrants for this property.
Wow.
And again, these are easy things to overlook. It's a small dot on the plans, and you know, it's something you can overlook pretty easy. But
14 fire hydrants 14. For any property just seems like kind of an excess amount.
It is, and what's interesting is the you know the fire department's never going to stop and say, hey, you know, when it's going through the approval process, you know, they're never going to stop and say, hey, why are you putting 14 fire hydrants? They'd love for you to put 14 fire hydrants, but the cost associated with 14 fire hydrants, it's immense. And at the end of the day, we're putting 4 fire hydrants total. You know, the fire code in California in the region that we're in, we're building in right here, stipulates that as long as the fire hydrants are 300 feet apart, you only need to put one every 300 feet. And so 14 was way, way excessive.
It's just outrageous.
Yeah. And so
and installing them is a whole headache on its own as well.
Yeah, you were part of that process. It's a lot of work, and the materials are very expensive. The whole process is expensive. So yeah, just making sure again these little things add up to big problems.
Yep. So how long did the city say approvals would take, and versus kind of how long did they actually take?
Yeah, so on this project, I remember originally going in and they said that this would be 6 to 8 months to go through the whole entire process. And so the reality is it took 2.5 years. And I would say that that's partially our fault by hiring, I think, not the right architect at the end of the day. And two, it was COVID. And they were under different constraints. The architectural firm was under different constraints. And so it kind of slowed things down. But I still don't think it should have been 2.5 years. And so the city that we're working with works 4 days a week. They're off on Fridays. And so it just seems like every time you're ready to do something, you know, they're catching up on Monday. Yeah. And so it just, everything always takes longer.
Right.
So whatever you're anticipating, I'd say pat it.
If you could give one piece of advice to someone going through the permit process, what would it be? After you've, you know, jumped through all these hoops and, you know, cut costs effectively, what's one piece of advice you would give to a listener out there?
Yeah, so they give you a lot of information right from the beginning. And again, if you're just going to hire an architect, that's their you know responsibility, and that's where it's crucial to have an architect that understands the city and has brought things through it, because they're going to be privy to most of this information. But I still think that this is important information for you know the listeners, if you're going to get involved in this, to read yourself and be part of. I think that being you know tirelessly relentless about reading and understanding all the details that the city is requiring will make the project go smooth. There is a lot to it, and I know it's storage and it's, you know, the metal building with the simple roll-up door, but there still is a tremendous amount of detail that goes into these facilities, and really understanding what the city wants to stay ahead of it, I think is crucial.
That's awesome. Now, I wanted to ask, did you have any good, bad, or ugly stories worth mentioning?
I've got quite a few, but I would say the one that's obviously most current, this project we're working on right now, the fee structure came through at the end when we were, you know, we finally were ready to pick up the permits. And they, you know, you could ask in the beginning for them to do an analysis on the fee structure, and their, you know, their responsibility is to do that for you. But they came back through on this project, and as I mentioned, it's 77,400 square feet, and I don't know, I don't have the exact number, but it came back at $1.5 million in permit fees.
Wow.
And that was going to kill the project. We did not factor $1.5 million for permit fees. What we were able to do is negotiate some of these fees. And so we were able to really break down each fee. And These are the things that I think most people don't think that fees in the city are negotiable.
Right.
And they absolutely are. And do they make mistakes? They absolutely do. And they made some pretty horrific mistakes with us. The biggest one, and you know, we could touch on some of the other ones, but the one that was the biggest impact was the traffic impact fee. And it's almost as if, at least in this city, something that is subjective to what they want to charge. It wasn't really cut and dry. We argued this point for months, but at the end, they did reduce it. And again, partially back to one of the points that I made, that there is not a lot of traffic that's generated in self-storage. And they had us categorized in retail rather than commercial. And these fees make a big difference, whether or not it's, you know, again, 77,000 square feet would be like building a, you know, a Walmart or something. And so the traffic impact on a Walmart versus a self-storage is night and day.
Right.
And
yeah, so what happened with that miscategorization under being under retail? What was the difference in terms of money?
Yeah, we ended up, so there's two parts to that. It's about $1.70 something per foot for retail. Again, and we were 77,000 square feet, and warehousing is like 75 cents a square foot.
Oh my gosh.
And what's interesting, when you first come back with the city on a lot of these things, their first reaction is, they don't want to be wrong. And they were pretty adamant about that's what it is. And so, we were persistent and we stuck with it. We were able to get the fees down, and it's a multiple of different areas. It wasn't just the transportation impact fee. It was sewer hookup. It was, they had us miscategorized. There's something called school bonds that you pay into with the county, and they had us miscategorized on that. They had a special fee specifically for self-storage, which was much less than the fee that they were assessing us for. And so I guess the real takeaway here is, I think most people would get the permits and just pay them. They wouldn't even question whether or not they're right or wrong. And I'm here to tell you that you really need to, line by line, make sure that the permit fees are in line with what should be being charged. And if it's not correct, you have the right to go back and negotiate these. And we did. And we were able to save, it wasn't a full $1 million, but it was close to $900,000 in fees, which saved the project. Wow. And is a tremendous amount of money.
No, that's amazing. And I think you're spot on with how important it is to tell the listeners that these permits are negotiable. I mean, as a young guy, I would have no idea. I mean, I would have been in the same category as people who get a permit and, you know, just say, okay, it is what it is. I mean, there's no other way around it, you know?
Yeah. One other thing that I would say as part of that is that a lot of cities at this point, they're trying to get you to pull separate permits for each building. And they might say that that's for inspection purposes, or, you know, to me, again, this is not fair. This is a way to increase their fees. And you really want to make sure, this is another very crucial point when you're going in there, make sure that you're saying that, hey, we want to pull this as one permit. Now, if you want to do it in phases and it's a big project and you're planning on doing it in one or two phases, that's a different story. But when they're asking to make you separately permit each building that you're doing, that's a fee grab at that point. And that's another way that it will really impact what it's going to cost you to build this. Again, in California, it varies. It varies from about $6 a square foot for permit fees all the way to $20 a square foot. The $20 is about what we were going to be charged, the $1.5 million. We ended up paying about $8 a foot at the end. But if you're in LA County or if you're in San Francisco, yeah, you could probably anticipate paying $20 a foot. And, you know, it's substantial. And again, what it's doing, it's creating the barriers to entry in this asset class It's making it really difficult for the ma and pop to get in. We're starting to see it more and more in the major metros, is that there are very few ma and pops left, and very few getting into those major metros. Those are really being relegated to the big, you know, REITs and, you know, multi facility owned, you know, groups. And so it's kind of pushing the ma and pop further and further into the, you know, the rural project. And so anyway, there's probably another, you know, podcast just on that topic as well. So Dylan, after going through this whole process, what would you tell someone who thinks building a self-storage facility is easy?
I'd tell them to do their homework for sure. The more you prepare before buying land, the fewer surprises you'll have. And I think you know, clearly made that super adamant in this episode. And, you know, I thank you for all the tips and knowledge that you've shared with us today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Love it.
So, you know, here are our final takeaways for anyone looking to develop a self-storage project in California. Number one, start with zoning and a general plan review. You know, if storage isn't allowed, move on. Number two, do your environmental due diligence. A phase one ESA and wetland check can save you from a nightmare. Number three, talk to the city early. You know what permits you need and how long they'll take. And four, plan for delays. Everything takes longer than expected. You know that. Budget extra time and money.
All right, that wraps up episode two of The Good,
the Bad,
and the Ugly of Self-Storage. If you found this helpful, be sure to subscribe and join us for the next episode, where we'll dive into site preparation and grading, what you need to know before breaking ground. Dylan, any last words?
Just that this is a process. You don't want to rush into this. Do it right from the start, and you'll save yourself a ton of headaches.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you on the next episode.
Thanks for tuning in to The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly of Self-Storage. We hope you found today's episode valuable. If you enjoyed the podcast, please like us, leave a review, and share it with others. For more tips and updates, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. You can also listen to us on your favorite podcast app. Until next time, let's unlock the potential of self-storage together.